Last week we focused on Avraham and Sarah, and we began the class talking about one of the complications of understanding their relationship is that we don't see the beginning of their relationship. We have the opposite issue here when it comes to Yitzchak and Rivka, that we know all about the beginning of their relationship, and it's certainly a very unique beginning to relationship. So just to kind of review, Avram thinks it's time for Yitzchak to find a wife. Sarah has already died, and Avram realizes that he's getting older and he kind of wants to make sure that there's going to be a next generation. So he appoints his servant Eliezer to find a wife for his son. The servant is nervous. How many know who the right person is? He asks Hashem, show me a sign. He asks Hashem, how about this for a sign? If a woman offers water to not just me, but to my camels, then I'll know it's the right one. Okay? So, well, look, yeah. We need something. It's good as anything else. So, that then the servant has to go back to the family. He's got to negotiate and try to convince them to go along with this. Ultimately, she's the one who puts her foot down and says, I'm going to do this, I'm going to marry him sight unseen. So,
why?
What? Okay, so why? Let's discuss this. So, right from the beginning, we have a very interesting dynamic in which Rivka is marrying into a family she hasn't met. Now, it's a very different dynamic. Yaakov, when he ends up meeting his wife, it's really the opposite dynamic. He's the one who's alone, and he's got to kind of convince them to accept him. Here, this is the reverse. She's got to go sight unseen, and she's got to leave her family to go to him, as opposed to Yaakov, who really left his family to live with her family, right? Typically, that's what happens. I always, typically you move closer to her family. That's what I always say, is that, wherever your wife is from, in 10 years, somehow you'll be in, you'll be living near there somehow. So, that's what tends to happen. So, this is kind of a different dynamic. She's being pulled away from her family, and we see no reference to them even being in touch after this, right? I mean, this seems to be a real falling out after she leaves the family, and not really until Yaakov goes back and meets Laban, her brother, and the rest of the family, is there any sort of interaction. It seems quite clear Yaakov has never met his cousins before, right? He doesn't know who any of them are, and he's very surprised, and they're surprised to meet him. So, she's really, leaving her family, starting over, and marrying this guy she's never met. Not, a pretty risky situation.
Okay.
She doesn't necessarily know exactly where she's going. Sorry.
He could be lying.
What?
She knows nothing about Eliezer.
He came, he told a story, told a history. Right. They knew the names.
Yeah, and he had. Yeah.
She knew revolution.
But he wasn't. How well known was he?
They knew the family. They knew who the family was. We knew who their family was. They must have known who Abraham's family was.
But still, typically.
It's an unknown that she's
done. It's still some of an unknown. She doesn't know them personally. She doesn't know exactly what they're about. She knows of them. She knows about them. Maybe she'll be a good fit. Maybe she won't be a good fit. She knows about Abraham, but what's the son like? I don't really know.
I think what's most interesting is that they asked her.
The fact
that they asked her, given at the time and given the culture of that time, that they asked her. What she wants to do, it's up to her.
Well, last week you were the big advocate, we don't know how male-dominated the society was, that was you last week, so maybe it wasn't as male-dominated as we assumed.
We don't know, but we can assume, but the fact that Abraham didn't ask Sarah to cover herself up. He sort of said, this is a threat if you want to save me. It wasn't her feelings and what's going to happen to her wasn't really
okay.
A consideration. So,
most people, when it comes to their own families, are not able to look at their families objectively. Yes. Right? We're very likely to, we'll look with rose-colored glasses at our own families. So even though her family was manipulative, they might have treated her badly, and who knows, they might have tried to pawn her off to the local businessman who'd give him a good deal. But it takes a lot of strength to be able to stand up to all that and say, I know you're my family, but you know what? You're bad people and I'm out of here. That takes strength. That really takes strength. And to her credit, I mean, of all the things Rivka does in her life, of all personality traits she has, she's not afraid to buck the trend. She's very strong. And she's not afraid to stand up to the strongest of influences, which we see at the end of her life is essential because she stands up to Yitzchak, right? That same personality trait is what ends up driving her to stand up to Yitzchak. She's strong, but she ends up really being very alone, and certainly in the beginning as well, because she's going on this journey. Now, okay, let's put herself let's put ourselves in her shoes. You more than me. Okay, so you are now this young bride being whisked away to meet this man you've heard about who you've never met. You don't know anyone who even knows them. You can't even, like, ask a friend about this person, right? You can't go on their Facebook profile and see what they look like, right? This is, so you're going sight unseen. What role is she stepping into here? Let's think, let's look at the pasuk.
What page are you?
I'm on page 120. So let's look at just how complicated the situation she's stepping into, so we can kind of understand the mindset she needs and how she has to adjust. So let's go to verse 64 on page 121. We'll read in English. Page 121, verse 64. And Rebekah raised her eyes and saw, she inclined while upon the camel, and she said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field toward us? So now she is with the servant Eliezer, and they're now approaching their Avram and Yitzchak's area, and she sees Yitzchak in the distance. And the servant said, he is my master, that's your future husband, Mazel Tov. She then took the veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things he had done, right? So there's quite a story here, right? This is what happened. The camels and I convincing her and this and that, and she said, I'm going to go. So Eliezer tells Yitzchak all that had happened. And Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. He married Rebekah, she became his wife, and he loved her. And thus was Isaac consoled after his mother. Okay, that's a very emotionally loaded pasuk. So what's going on in this pasuk? What sticks out to you in this pasuk?
Isaac's being consoled. It's very poignant to wait the progression of the sentence. First he brought her into the tent of his mother.
Right.
He married her, she became his wife, and he loved her.
Right.
That's, it's beautiful. It's it tells a story in one sentence.
Okay, so what's the story it's telling? So what is this? What is Rivka's role here? What is she stepping into?
She's nurturing.
Okay, but what is
also the female as a matriarch? Because
yes, the mom is substitute.
Right.
There was no one to fulfill that role.
Right. So now he loves her. How? He loves her in what way?
I think he needs support. He's been through a very traumatic experience. He needs someone to make him feel like a human being again.
Okay, right. So she's now a lot of things here, right?
Yes.
She is now the female in this family. It's Yitzchak and his father. She is now the female. She is the matriarch.
Seems that it's obvious that she took over because the next sentence deals with Abraham building a new family. And
right.
Not replacing
exactly.
Sarah, he's gone.
Right. The next pasuk, very good point. The next pasuk, Abraham proceeded and took a wife whose name is Keturah. She has more kids. Abraham starts a second life after Sarah dies. And that's it. We don't hear from Abraham again until
it's
he dies.
It's interesting. Yeah. That tells a lot about the relationship between Abraham and Sarah.
In what way?
Well, he didn't want to, it wasn't particularly, I mean, he had his son settled in there, so her role was taken, I can put her behind me, I can possibly undo what I did to Yitzchak with the Akedah, and he sort of distances himself from the whole business.
Well, he defers.
He's not sitting and mourning the rest of his life over Sarah.
No, he moves on with his life for sure. The good and the bad of it, right? Right. He lives quite a number of more years afterwards, right. and he remarries and starts another life afterwards. But he kind of goes into retirement, right? Yeah. If you can retire from the role of leader of the Jewish people, Avraham does that. I don't know how one does that exactly, but Avraham does that.
So we don't realize how the event was very traumatic for Avraham at all, and he just said, "I've had enough. I'm burnt out."
From which episode? From the Akedah?
From the Akedah.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
It wasn't only Yitzhak.
Right, that's true. No, that's true. And also knowing the time is right, meaning at some point, if you don't hand over the reins, you end up stifling the next generation. Right? I mean, like, look at Prince Charles. He can't be king anymore. It's too long. He's too old to now take over that role. You know, it's passed him by. And you almost have to skip a generation at this point. So, if you don't pass over the reins at a certain point, it just becomes too late. And so maybe he thinks now's the time for Yitzchak. He's got his wife. He's old enough. Now it's time for him to do it. And which takes a certain level of humility to be able to do that, because very few people are able to do something like that. Right? They're most people, certainly in any position of power, want to hold on as long as possible. Avram is able to fade in the background, which is not a simple thing.
Could have been guilt.
We don't know. We don't know exactly what's going on in his head.
The whole fascinating thing about this is because there are relationships that intertwine, and it's written in such a way that you can really see anything you want to in here. You don't know what went on with Avram. We don't even know how old Yitzchak was. We know that he was absolutely terrified with this whole
thing. Well, Rashi thinks, based on the numbers, he's 37 for the Akedah.
All right, but when Yaakov is referring to Laban, making the most solemn swear he can that he's ripping him off and he really doesn't mean to, etc., etc., he says, "Al pachad avi Yitzchak." He says, and it's the only time where they use the word pachad. Pachad means fear.
Right.
It's not yira. So and he swears two times on the fear that Yitzchak went through, which must have been monumental.
Well, yeah.
And so there you have the whole reaction, the Yitzchak reaction of what happened to him in his life and what became of him and what effect did it have on his personality.
Yeah, so that we can discuss.
What is interesting is what happened to Rivka that she, did she see him and fall in love with him? Did she fell off the camel?
Well, It says he loves her. No, she comes down. She descends to meet him.
She doesn't descend. She falls.
There are a few explanations.
Why? Yeah. What did she see? What caused her to have such a strong reaction? The reality of what she's getting into, you know, hit her. You know, here I am. I thought it was going to be great. You know, but this is wake up and smell the coffee time. And what impact did that have? You know, her seeing him. What did that really have on her? Probably.
It says
they were supposed to be good looking. I've heard Medrashim that they were.
It's not the biggest focus. Not a big focus about the men if they're good looking. The women, it says, were beautiful. The men, it's not as big a focus. But that's a whole other.
There's only one interpretation that she fell according to.
Yeah, it says here, the Ramban says she fell. Rashi said that she's kind of like slowly went down the camel. But I really wanted to focus on this. On this dynamic here. So look at Rashi. Rashi has two commentaries. And what does it mean that she...
Kipo means to fall.
Yeah, but it could be to descend. Yeah.
Your aid is to descend.
I don't know where you are.
Kipo me'al hagamo.
I can't read Hebrew.
If you look at the English translation.
Well, that doesn't mean anything.
On 64.
And each English is different, and most of them are wrong.
No, that's a fair point. I want to focus on the Rashi here on 67. So I'll read in Hebrew, then I'll translate.
Are you on page 123 in the English?
Page 121 still. Yeah, I'm just going to read the commentary. We'll discuss the commentary.
Is this 120?
So on the bottom of this is Rashi. Yeah. Oh. So it says on Samach Zion 67. Ha'ola Sarimo, Vayavoha Ha'ola Vahari Hi Sarimo. So he went into the tent of Sarah, kilomers, as if to say, "Venasi dugmat Sarah imo," as if, you know, she's the new Sarah to a certain extent. She calls mancha Sarah kayemet, as long as Sarah was alive. Hayaner daluk me'erav Shabbos le'erav Shabbos. There was a candle lit in the home from one Friday to the next. Ubrachim atzuya be'isa, and there was blessing found in the dough. Be'ainan kashur ala ohel, and there was like a protective cloud around the tent. And when she meta pasku, when she died, that left. Ukeshebat Rivka chazru. But when Rivka came, it returned. So, if this is literal or not, I think it's certainly painting an image here of the difference. First, the difference the feeling of a home has when there is a female in it versus just a man in it, right? A home with just a man. You know, I just saw this thing. There's this guy. He's like his early 20s, and his family is in the wool business in Portland, Oregon, and he was in college, and he realized that he and his friends hated doing laundry so much that he invented a shirt you can wear for 100 straight days without having to wash it.
This is a true story.
It's a true story. And this has now become like a really popular clothing item for like college men who don't want to do any laundry. So you can wear it, like it doesn't stay. Adam, they use this, I don't know, all the dynamics of it. You can look it up. It's very interesting. But it's like a real hot seller. Like they produced like 100,000. They sold that right away. And now they have to make like another 300,000. Anyway, right? So, you know, that's what a guy's dorm is going to look like. So the feel of a home, when there's a woman in it, just the whole thing changes. The whole dynamic changes. So here, now that Rivka has moved in, so the whole dynamic changes. But we see right from the beginning that Rivka, she's not just herself, she is now Sarah's replacement. Which is a complicated relationship.
Horrible.
What?
It's horrible.
It's not so simple, right? That's a tough, yeah.
There's something in her that when she looked at him, she was overwhelmed, overawed by the... So she was knocked out by what he looked like. It tells you.
But you can imagine...
Well, she expected a horror.
You know. Yeah.
Well, but again, imagine the build-up here, right? She's being whisked away. She's being courted from afar. She's given this wealth. She's told about this amazing family and this amazing guy she's going to marry. It's a few days' journey. It's a few days' journey to get there. Imagine just the drama and the anticipation, the build-up. Meaning, it's just going to be the actual moment when you see him, when you've been thinking about it for how long, it's just going to be an overwhelming experience, right? And then
he was attractive.
Yeah, but even if he wasn't, right?
She fell for him.
What? But just you can imagine the picture she'd made in her own mind already of what he was going to be at the moment was just going to be overwhelming. So he said,
but how he could not be looking for a wife himself?
Okay, so why is this the way that he goes about that they go about it? It's a good question, and it shows a little bit of Yitzchak kind of being an extension of his father to a certain extent. Part of it is that Yitzchak never leaves Israel, in that they felt that the best place to find a wife was outside of Israel. So Yitzchak was supposed to be like this, you know, holy man who never left Israel. Partly, maybe as the one interpretation is that the fact that he was supposed to be offered as a sacrifice, he's viewed as like being sanctified to a certain extent. Or maybe, you know, Yitzchak's role is very different. That Avram was this builder and creator, and Yitzchak's role was more to kind of establish a foundation. He wasn't as ambitious, he wasn't as charismatic, but he was kind of more the strong, silent type. So his role was more, he wasn't quite the same role. Yeah.
Hirsch follows like a tapestry, a theory of the Geula and the whole story of the Jewish history. And he starts by saying, like, Abraham, who was the first father, is he didn't have any enemies. He was loved. He was the doer. And the first anti-Semitic and trying to take away the power from the Jews comes with Yitzchak, with the wells. So his And Yaakov was a third step where he was exiled. He was out. I mean, he lived most of his life away. You know,
out of Israel. Right?
So it's like a progression thing, you know, doing the history.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Yitzchak was, he must have been a personality that was more... He was more open to this kind of threats that were coming at him. He was softer, probably, in many ways than Abraham was, because he, you know, things happened to him that they wouldn't dare do to Abraham.
Maybe to a certain extent.
He had a certain persona, Abraham, that Yitzchak.
His persona is more passive, for sure.
He was a passive person.
Yeah, meaning he's definitely acted upon more than others. Right, Abraham was more the proactive, the doer. Yeah, Yitzchak is definitely acted upon more throughout his life.
God tells Abraham, go.
Right.
Everything, go. Same thing with Yaakov. And Isaac is...
Stay. Right. Yeah. The message of Yitzchak is stay, right, not go. But you need that to a certain extent. You know, it's like I compare it to a company. That, you know, when a company starts, there's the startup phase. And the startup phase is exciting and interesting, and everything's changing. It's growing very quickly. And at some point, though, you have to get up. You have to stop the startup phase. You have to start building management and in HR. And you have to do all that stuff that's not as fun anymore. But if you don't do it, the company falls apart, right? And then once you've solidified your infrastructure, now you can build and grow again, right? So to a certain extent, that's kind of like Avram's a startup phase, and Yitzhak is the infrastructure phase. And then once that's set up a little better, now Yaakov can be the next phase. So I kind of look at it, the progression that way. Rav Hoytner kind of puts it, not quite in the business terms, but Rav Hoytner kind of uses that way of thinking, Yitzhak's role in this. But Rivka plays a very important role in this, because Yitzhak needs the kick in the pants sometimes, or he needs a little extra energy and strength, and she provides that, right? She really provides that. And what's interesting is Eliezer's mission is to find a woman who's proactive, right? That's the whole plan, to find a woman who's going to, on her own, offer water to the camels. Maybe he realizes Yitzhak needs someone like that. He needs someone who's going to step forward, who's going to do it on her own, who doesn't need to be prompted, doesn't need to be cajoled. And maybe that's what he needs, and it ends up that is what he needs. So it's interesting that maybe it's, you know, the test really does fit what Yitzchak needs. So the first Rashi here we saw is how Rivka's playing this role. Now, this is a complicated role for Rivka to play, and it's interesting that while our patriarchs learn from each other, right? Yitzchak grows up in Avram's home and learns the ropes from him. Yaakov grows up in Yitzchak's home and learns the rope from him. Yosef and the brothers learn from Yaakov. But our matriarchs don't have that opportunity. None of them do. Sarah, obviously, she's the first one. Rivka never meets Sarah. Sarah's dead before she gets there. And then Rachel and Leah, they never meet Rivka either. So the matriarchs are really forced to go it alone. They don't have that motherly or mother-in-law figure, right? Better off that way. Maybe there's a message here about mother-in-laws, and you know, it's a great Gemara that I'll talk about later. The complications of the mother-in-law relationship, daughter-in-law relationship, but they don't have that. So Rivka is asked to be the matriarch in a dynamic she's never seen. And she really has to kind of figure it out for herself. She's being asked to replace Sarah when she's never met Sarah. So,
and she was so young.
And you know, we don't know exactly how young she was, but we assume she's pretty young. So I think, you know, that's going to color her relationship to Yitzhak. And there is a bit of a power imbalance in this relationship, right? Avram and Sarah, they marry each other. And they're on equal footing from the outset. Yaakov actually is kind of begging Rachel to marry him, and the power imbalance is the opposite way. Rachel wields the power over Yaakov, and we see that really their entire life. He's always kind of seeking her affection. Here we have this opposite power dynamic. There's a difference in power here. She is being asked to marry the prince. She's the commoner marrying the prince. This is Princess Di marrying Prince Charles. That's a complicated dynamic because it means that, you know, they're coming into this relationship, and to a certain extent, he's up here, and now she's got to kind of work her way up to that point. So you add on top of that, she's leaving her family, she has to replace Sarah, she's got to play all these roles that she's never played before, seen before. So Rivka's coming into this relationship in a very difficult spot. Okay, so just, I think it's an important point to start out here.
But she knows about her predecessor. She knows what kind of a woman this was.
To the extent you can know someone who you've never met.
She knows about what she did and what she's capable of.
Right, but sometimes that helps and sometimes that just adds pressure.
Yeah.
Right, because whenever the expectation is be like that person, that's a very difficult way to live. Because you can never do that. Right, you can never really be that person because you're not that person. So all you can do is try to be yourself within the role that they live, but ultimately you can only do it so much. And you know, and you kind of chuckled, you know, when we talked about, you know, replacing his mother. So, right? I mean,
Oedipus,
right? You know, the women when they get married, they're certainly afraid of, you know, their mother-in-law wielding too much influence over their husband, and many a relationship have gotten off to rocky starts when the wife feels that his mother is too opinionated, or he's a mama's boy, right?
Yeah,
that becomes a big issue. Are you married to me, or are you married to your mother? What's going on here? So that becomes a very big issue.
They like the fact that the sorrow wasn't around.
That's what we were saying before. To a certain extent, it might make it easier, right? Because, right, you know, there's different dynamics, but that tends to be a complicated dynamic. So maybe that is to a certain extent, it is to her benefit, but it's complicated.
Abraham leaves, you know, so.
Well, we don't know, like, how far he goes away, because it seems like he's still in their lives.
He's still in their lives somewhat, but he sort of. It goes back to the extremely complicated Abraham-Sarah relationship that he didn't train Rivka, you know, be like Sarah or anything or take after. She sort of reinvented the role.
Right, which is what you want, really.
Which was fine. He sort of just pulled back from the whole business.
Right. No, for sure. So look at the second Rashi, because this just kind of confirms our suspicions here. So look at what Rashi says. This is Rashi in the same pasuk, 60 in Sama Zayin, says Achrei Imo, Derech Eretz, the way of the world, Kol Zman Sheimo Shel Adam Kayemes, as long as the mother of a man is alive, Karach Hu Etzla. He still leans on her. It's in the commentary, so yeah, I'll just translate it. So as long as a man's mother is alive, he leans on her. Umishemeta Hu Mitnachem Beishto. And when his mother dies, then he's comforted by his wife. So basically saying that a man has a different relationship with his wife depending on if his mother is alive or not. Because that role of a female figure in his life, as opposed to being split in two, now becomes mixed into one. Now, there could be some bad to that, right? Because there are men who treat their wives as their mothers, and that's not healthy either, right? So, Rivka is walking into that a little bit, that he's comforted by Rivka, so now she's really playing a lot of roles and juggling a lot of different things here right from the outset. So I just wanted to start off with that, because it's important to note that they're really coming from two different perspectives. And I think that plays out very quickly. So let's go to page 124, 125.
Oh, he was
40. He's 40 when he marries her, yeah. And these are the offspring of Isaac, son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, daughter of Betuel, the Aramean, from Padan Aram, sister of Lavan, the Aramean, as a wife for himself. Isaac entreated Hashem opposite his wife because she was barren. Hashem allowed himself to be entreated by him, and his wife Rebekah conceived. So again, we see barrenness, but not the same intensity as we saw with Sarah, right? Sarah, we saw from the very beginning, was defined as barren. The first time the Torah mentions her, she was the barren Sarah. Here, Rebecca's barren, but it doesn't seem that big of a focus in the text. Okay? They davened and it was fixed. Like, that was pretty simple, relatively speaking. The children agitated within her, and she said, "If so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of Hashem. And Hashem said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two regimes from your inside shall be separated. The might shall pass from one regime to the other, and the elder shall serve the younger." Okay. So, in Rashi and in the Midrash, there's a lot of focus here on the disparity between the families they grew up in. This becomes a very big focus, and it becomes a big focus for them internally as well. How so? So, number one, it says that Yitzchak davened for them. Why is Yitzchak daven? So, as opposed to Rivka davening. So, Rashi says, Lo velola, sorry, I'm just in the commentary.
Oh.
Yeah. Lo velola, he davened, not her. She'ein doma tefila tzadik ben Rasha, la tefila tzadik ben Tzadik. Levidech lo velola, because you can't compare the tefila, the prayer of a righteous person, the son of a righteous person, versus a righteous person who's the children of wicked people, which is what Rivka was considered. So already we're seeing quite an imbalance here. Through no fault of Rivka's own, she doesn't seem to wield the same influence, certainly with Hashem even, that Yitzchak does.
That seems very unfair.
It does seem very unfair. And
that's a very weird thing to say.
And it's somewhat against some core Jewish principles,
yes,
that we feel, yeah, that the Baal Tshuva, yeah, has a strength,
yeah,
that someone,
yeah,
who comes to it on their own, look, Avram and Sarah, they came to it on their own, and that's why we praise them so much.
Can people on their own do something? I mean, are we doomed?
Right, so it doesn't say that her prayers aren't answered. It just says that it seems that on some level, he has his merits and he has his parents' merit. And, well, I do believe, you know, I do believe on some level, maybe this is just me, I do believe on some level that the good we do in our lives, you know, can affect future generations. I like to believe that that's the case, right? That there's a certain amount of, and we see examples of that, you know, throughout Torah, that, you know, if someone does good in their life, there's a certain amount of blessing that kind of, that Hashem will pass on, you know.
Everything is consequential.
Right.
Everything what people do is consequential. The consequences for everything.
Right.
Perhaps in this thing, they're not dealing really with Rivka's personality. I mean, she is a person who learned how to deceive and manipulate from where she comes from, and she carried it out.
Right.
So, you know, Yitzchak was a straight shooter because
That's what he learned.
That's what he was. That's
right.
What he learned. And he went through all sorts of things. So he just chose to be more, you know, straight and narrow. Maybe because Rivka was more complex and she did know how to manipulate and she did know how to try to get her way. And so maybe Yitzchak was in a better position to get something because he was purer in that sense.
Yeah, that could be, yeah.
There's another commentary about Yitzchak here.
Yeah.
He knew that he would have children because God had promised that Abraham's destiny would be fulfilled to Isaac's offspring. He didn't know that Rebecca, Rivka...
Okay, good. So let's segue with that because that's it's an important point.
Yeah, can I go back to something? If she was manipulative, it was because she had to be to survive. It didn't mean she was a bad person.
No, not at all.
Not necessarily. Manipulation isn't necessarily a bad thing.
But sometimes it's the best thing, right. Right, as we
the way
see,
to get
right.
things done.
It's diplomacy is...
Yeah, but she was able to
right,
see
sure.
what had to be done in order to get...
Yeah, but it
things.
Didn't mean that she was committing sins.
No.
It meant she was more complex.
But I mean, we're talking about, you know, when God listens to prayer, which is just a realm of understanding, we, you know, that's beyond our regular
yeah,
realm.
Yeah, right.
You know, right. The idea that God, when God listens to prayer, he's taking into account other merits in the family that somehow, you know, if a parent or grandparent had a lot of merit in their life, that somehow that affects, you know, Hashem will take that into account, right? And we see this all the time in our Yom Kippur davening, right? We're always asking, we ask Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and we ask, you know, our matriarchs to, you know, appease Hashem for us. And the Midrash talks about this. Sarah cried for her children. You know, Rachel cries, and Rachel appeases Hashem, and Rachel davens for us. So we see that we do that to a certain extent as well. So there is this concept that somehow that impacts God's decision-making as to when to listen to prayer. So it might not be about who's more or less righteous. It might just be a system that Hashem has that's beyond, you know, in a different realm than we are. But to get back to what you were saying before, there is this fear. There's a very interesting fear here because... So we have to always go back to this. The only precedent Rivka had was Sarah, right? And Sarah, A, had been barren. And when she was barren, what happened? Avram took another wife, and this got complicated. So she is very afraid, right? And she's not so secure in her role, and she's not sure how this is going to play out. So she's very nervous when she's barren, because what if, does this mean that there's going to be another wife? Interestingly, she's the only one who doesn't have, there's no second wife in this family, you know, mm-hmm. right? Avram, certainly Sarah has that, and Rachel and Leah have that, and more. So, to a certain extent, this is the most nuclear family we have, right? But while it's the most nuclear family we have, it's also the only family where there is a bad child, the bad seed, that comes from that actual relationship, as opposed to with Yishmael, well, you could always blame it on Hagar. Oh, that's because that was his mom.
Bad blood.
The bad, right. Yeah, she was, yeah, you know, they should have married her in the first place, right? And we don't consider any of Yaakov's children to being the bad seed, although they have a complicated, you know, dynamic. We don't go that far. There's no Esav in the bunch. But here we have the most nuclear family produces the Esav, right? And this is from Rivka and from Yitzchak. So that makes their dynamic, their couple dynamic very interesting, because Yitzchak might not be able to see it that way, right? How could, right? He might be thinking, Esav can't come from me and you, it would have to be from a Hagar. And she's able to say, well, it's not that simple, right? It's not that simple. But okay, we'll get to that in a second. But they definitely have this dynamic. Now, it says that she gets nervous when she's pregnant, right? She's nervous. The children were agitated within her, and she said, why am I in this? And she went to inquire of Hashem. Now, why does she go to Hashem? So what does it mean she went to Hashem? So Rashi says it means she went to the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever, which is a very interesting little side note in the Midrash, that there was like, that Shem Ve'Ever are descendants of Noah, like the righteous descendants of Noah, and they create some sort of school of like philosophy and theology. And this is where Yaakov ends up going, and this is where she goes. It's like this little enclave that stayed true to Noah's roots while a lot of the rest of the world doesn't. So she goes to them. And the question many ask is, well, if she was so nervous about what's happening, why did she go to Yitzchak, go to Avraham? Her father-in-law's Avraham. Say, go to Avraham, hey, something's weird here, this pregnancy feels weird, I'm a little nervous about it. Can you ask Hashem what's going on? But she doesn't go to Avram. She goes to the outsider, Shem Ve'Ever. So why does she go to the outsiders? So the Sifsei Chachamim says, because she was nervous. She was nervous to bring this up with Avram. And, you know, that Avram ends up dying before Esav goes bad. Right? Avram dies before Esav turns 15. So that Avram doesn't see Esav in his lifetime kind of go bad. But we see that there's a certain amount of shielding here, that Avram and Yitzchak are being shielded from reality a little bit. Right? They're being shielded from what's really going on here. And she maybe wants to protect them from this a little bit, because she, you know, when she gets this prophecy that there's two nations in your womb, one's good and one's not gonna be so good, doesn't seem like she tells Yitzchak about this. Right? She kind of keeps this within her. Which might be one reason why she knew Esav was going to be trouble down the road more than Yitzchak did, because she had been told this prophecy. So why didn't she tell Yitzchak this prophecy?
Because it's her child. She, even though he's going to be rotten, she'll love him.
For sure, but, I mean, Yitzchak would love him too. But maybe she's a little nervous of her role in the family here. She's nervous to be the mother of the Esav, right? She's not so secure in her role here, since she is the outsider, since she is the children of wicked people. She doesn't have this. There's a little bit of insecurity as to, can I lose this role? How will I be looked at? she's a little bit nervous about this. And I think that's also part of the dynamic that really they have their entire life coming from that power imbalance.
I never understood the Yaakov Esav thing, why Esav is considered evil and Yaakov. It certainly, what's in the Chumash doesn't indicate either of it, and it seems to be a whole scenario built up by rabbis, trying to...
It's a good question. That's a very good question.
But there is no indication anywhere in the Torah about either of them being anything.
Yeah, at a young age.
At any age. Yaakov's behavior doesn't indicate that he's a great tzaddik.
Well, we see...
And nothing Esav does indicate that he's a great Rasha.
Well, we see who he marries is a problem. We see the fact that Esav was...
Then he marries someone else also. And it was a time... I mean, it's not horrible.
No, but we see that Yitzhak and Rivka were very upset who he married, which we'll get to in a second.
Okay.
That doesn't make you evil. No, but it shows that they were questioning his decision-making and his righteousness to a certain extent. The fact that he sells the birthright, which is a very complicated story, might to some extent show there's something wrong here. But you're right. In the Midrash, it plays up the difference between Esav and Yaakov much more than the text does. And it definitely does become somewhat of a calling card as good versus evil. I would say in Midrash and later generations, it becomes more black and white, good versus evil. Yeah. In the text, it's not seen as good versus evil. It seems a complicated family, and Esav's a complicated character. Now, the fact that Rivka insists that Yaakov get the bracha over Esav also implies that he's the more worthy one to get this bracha. So she clearly thinks that he is the more worthy of the two. But you're right, the Midrash, every chance it gets to paint Esav in the worst possible light, it does so.
Yeah, 100%. You're trying to make a point, a historical issue, to justify something. So you start painting the thing, and I don't know if that's really the case. And I really have a lot of problems with it.
No, fair enough. Well, I would say especially to look at Esav as evil from birth is a very anti-Jewish idea. Because we believe strongly in the idea of free will, and then no one is predetermined if they're going to be good or evil. Yes, personality traits can be predetermined, and certain things are predetermined. But good and evil is not something predetermined. That's
Yaakov
a very
wanting the birthright shows more. Esav was more simplistic and didn't think in terms of that, and more. There were different types of people. I mean, Yaakov had the foresight to think what the birthright means, and I'm going to get it from him, so I'll take advantage when at a weak moment. It doesn't show great righteousness. It shows seeing what he wants and going after it and getting it.
I'm not sure that's the. I hear what you're saying. I don't want to focus on that story per se right now, but it's an interesting point. I want to get back to there, but I want to stay on the relationship between them. Okay, so again, we see this power imbalance being a focus here. The one time we really see them unified is in this, what we just referenced here. If you go to page 133. Okay, so verse Lamed Dalet 34, the bottom. When Esav was 40 years old, he took a wife, Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, up here, so 34.
Oh.
Yeah. And Basma, daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they were a source of spiritual rebellion to Isaac and Rivka. And spiritual rebellion, again, it's tough to translate this. It says in Hebrew, Vatiena morat ruach, like it impacted their spirit, right? Like it really brought them down, right? Basically, imagine being in a situation where your son or daughter brings home someone, and you're thinking, oh God, I hope they don't marry this person. This would be a disaster, right? So any parent in that situation will just be like somewhat deflated and, oh gosh, okay, now we got to deal with this one, right? So it's unclear exactly what the reasons they don't like them are, again, but the Midrash is happy to point out that this is for spiritual reasons. And Rashi says, why? Shehayu ovdut avodah zarah, because these women were idol worshippers. Of course, the entire world were pretty much idol worshippers at that point. But they felt that they were not good fits. Now, interesting that Esav is how old when he gets married?
40.
Like his father, right? So there is, this the dynamic between Yitzchak and Esav is fascinating. But he's copying him a little bit. And maybe he's buttering him up, or maybe he's... But the fact that he gets married the same age is like, hey, you know, Dad, I'm learning from you. The fact that he even mentions how old he was, because it doesn't seem that relevant. Who cares if he's 40 or 41? It seems that he's kind of mimicking his father a little bit.
Isn't that hard? I mean, these people, what I read from history, they got married very, very young, you know, 15, 16. That was...
Well,
what were they doing all these years? I mean, didn't they have relationships with people? Didn't they have family?
This is prehistory a little bit. I mean, this is going back well beyond history that we have as we know it. Yeah, if we take it face value, they live longer lives. It seems that they get married later. They're living to 127.
Maybe the whole number system is.
Yeah. So you know, if you're 127, so 40 would be like your, you know, like your 20s.
Right.
So it seems like you had many years to, you know. So your wild oats, whatever, yeah.
In Sephardic Jewish tradition, very often the man, the husband-to-be, is about 15 years older than the wife. One of the reasons is that he has to acquire property or have the capacity to be able to have a family and support them.
Right, he's expected.
And also, I mean, they always did because women didn't work. Yeah,
so. Right, he was expected to be independent by the time they got married, right? That's true. Right.
Looking at this thing, talking about what a rotter Esau was, but, you know, in terms of modern life, men are going wild, and when they're 40, you know, they're willing to stop chasing frequently.
Right.
So maybe he wasn't.
Unless they're politicians or athletes or movie stars or right. or any other number of professions or Wall Street. Yeah. Sorry. What were we saying? I'm sorry.
So that's what occurs to him, makes it more interesting. He's got experience.
Right, he's right. So right, by the age of 40, he's ready to settle down.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, if you live to 120, you've got a longer wild youth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But this thing of comparing him to swine, that's really terrible. Why are they?
Yeah, that's interesting. But, yeah, the idea is that, I mean, it's not literal, but that Esau would try to make it seem like he was more righteous than he was. That's the message. That getting married at 40 was kind of buttering up his father, saying, "Hey, Dad, I'm just like you. I want to learn just like you. I want to be just like you." Anyway, so here we go from seeing Yitzhak and Rivka unified in their displeasure for these marriages, to them being completely apart on determining who should be the next leader of this. Newfound religion. And let's ask why are Rivka and Yaakov so far apart on this, and why can't they talk about it? Right? Because if you remember, when it came to the Sarah Avram dynamic, when she didn't like something, what did Sarah do?
She told them
what's what, right? By the way, Hagar's leaving Ishmael, they're gone. I don't really like that, sorry, they're gone. Right? And Avram would defer to her. But Rivka and Yitzhak don't seem to have that dynamic, right? She's pretty convinced. She's convinced that she can't convince Yitzhak to change his mind on this. Her only option here, as she sees it, is to go behind his back.
She knew his weaknesses, and he liked good food, which Yitzhak provided him with something special. He was more of a gourmet. That there was a side to his character like that.
No, that's true, but it seems this is a fundamental, like, you know, this should go beyond this.
I'm thinking of the Pachad Yitzchak Avi sentence that Yaakov says. It must have been such a traumatic, because Abraham of the Akedah, to me, is pivotal in Judaism. It's something I totally don't understand. Period. Okay. But it must have been so traumatic for him, because Abraham goes back alone to the boys. He's gone, Yitzchak. And we don't know what effect that had on him. It had a tremendous effect on him, apparently. It was soul-changing for him. So he may have liked Esav because Esav was straight and forward and not complex, and what he saw is what he got. And Yaakov was thinking and manipulating.
I'll answer the dynamic
he
here.
See it.
So he can... So. Okay, so we'll start with that. Why does Rivka see Esav one way and Yitzchak sees him another way? Let's start with that. Yeah. What are some possibilities as to why that is? From what we've seen so far, especially, what would you say?
She sees her brother's attributes.
Okay, so maybe she just has more experience with people like this. right? She grew up in a family with people like this. And maybe she looks at Esav and says, you got these genes from me, right? You're from my side of the family, whether I like it or not. So, right, so one possibility, she can pick up on this better. And Yitzchak, having been shielded, having been protected for the most part, so much so that she doesn't even tell him about this prophecy. Maybe that's part of it. She just has, she's got a better radar for this. Okay, what other possibilities are there?
But she knew already when the babies in her womb that the one that was
going right. To so the second possibility, she had been told that early on, and never told Yitzchak. So she just had more information. Mm. So that's why she looked at it differently than he did. Second possibility. Okay.
Why did she never tell him?
Why did she never tell him? So we were saying before, maybe she never told him, certainly in the beginning, because she was just really nervous. You know, she wanted the perception that everything was fine. She didn't want any red flags here. Maybe I married the wrong person. Maybe you're not the right mother. Maybe you're not everything, you know. Sarah never had an Esav. What's wrong with you? Right? Maybe she didn't want to deal with all of that. And she figured it's better, you know, we'll deal with it down the road once our relationship's on more solid footing or whatever. Maybe it's a positive.
Maybe she didn't want him to prejudge the son.
Maybe.
To make up, you know, to see him in a certain light, which was going to be awful the way through.
And the truth is, that's very true with kids, right? That the biggest, too often parents at young ages prejudge, oh, this is the wild one, this is the smart one, this is the athletic one, this is the stupid one, right? Parents do it all the time, and it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy because, which, you know, if you're told from the age of five that you are this, you'll start to believe you are this. So, right, yeah, that's a good point. And the last thing, and like we said, if Esav is not predetermined to be wicked, he might be wild, but wild and wicked are not the same thing. He might be aggressive. Again, that's not the same thing. So maybe that's a good point. Maybe she doesn't need, you know, she doesn't need Yitzchak to hear all that. But the problem is, at some point, though, that becomes relevant information. When it becomes clear, at least in her mind, that Esav is not the right one to fulfill this role, so then this becomes a problem. And again, this could be, so that now when everything comes to a head, we see kind of all these things converge. We see Rivka's background, right? The fact that she grew up in a family that was somewhat manipulative. She knew how to do this, and she uses that skill really, I don't know if the first time, but certainly in the most extreme way she uses it now.
She's such a jerk.
What?
He's a jerk.
Who is?
Yitzchak.
I mean, he doesn't even know what's happening, yeah.
He's a loving father, really. He has two sons.
Right.
I think he just doesn't want to see.
That's probably the
truth. He just doesn't want to see anything. I think his experience was very traumatic, and I think he just shut off.
But
it says he was blind. I don't know how blind he was. And then he realizes that he made a mistake, but he lived for many years with blinkers on.
Right, but also think about this. Remember, we started with this, that what was incredible about what Rivka did is she was objective about her own family.
Yes.
Right? And she was able to leave her family because she could objectively look at them and say, you know what, you guys are not, I shouldn't be here anymore. And she's able to do the same thing with her kids. But Yitzchak might not have that same ability, which is a very hard thing to do. It's very hard to be objective, especially with your own children, of all people in this world.
And she wasn't exposed to this.
Right. I mean, yeah, my wife's a teacher, believe me. Every parent who calls up because they're, you know, every kid that gets a bad grade, it's the teacher's fault, right? It's always, why didn't you teach my kid better? Did your kid study? That's not the point, right? The point is, if you had taught him better, he wouldn't have needed to study. So, it's very difficult to be objective, and Rivka almost has a superhuman ability to be objective about her own family in a way that very few people could.
Very few parents
could. So she
didn't deny you.
I'm sorry?
Didn't deny you.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. And was Yitzchak in denial? Did he not fully know everything Esav was doing? Now look, also, I'll throw it out there, you know, mothers tend to have a better sense what's going on with their kids than fathers do, you know, much more often. And again, you know, as a teacher, you know, my wife would tell me when she sits down with both parents and has like a you know, just the parent-teacher conferences, the mother has a better sense of who the kids' friends are, how they're doing in school, who the teachers are, what they're learning. The mother tends to have a much better sense of these things, and the dad's like sitting there in the conference, like, oh, really, they're doing that? Oh, that's interesting. I had no idea, right? So it would make more sense on some level that the mother would just have a better sense of who Esau really was behind the scenes, because she just might have seen it more, been around it more. Doesn't excuse Yitzhak for not knowing at all. You should have a pretty basic sense of who your kid is. But, you know, it could very well be. And again, the possibility of denial, the possibility, it's not just denying my son is like this. Remember, there's, you know, when a parent is denying what my kid is like, they're also really saying, I couldn't be the parent of a child like that, right? What does it say about me if that's my child? And then we're dealing with all that. So here, we're not just dealing with a regular parent. Again, we're dealing with these parents who are founding this new nation based on morality and monotheism and all this. The stakes are much higher. To say, this is my wicked son, is a very complicated psychological thing to deal with for someone like Yitzhak. Because again, Avram had that son, but it was Hagar's fault.
Why does it have to be wicked son and just not inappropriate son?
Okay, you're right. Wicked is unfair. I agree. Wicked's going too far. A son, to say that I have a son that's not, that shouldn't, you know, that's not appropriate for this role, might be a hard thing for a parent to, you know, to grapple with. And look,
we
see.
You have a choice. I mean, you have two children, and they're more or less the same age, given a few minutes. And so you can make that judgment and say this one seems better suited for the role than
you
this
could,
one.
And you could,
without necessarily destroying the kid.
For sure.
Not necessarily. Saying, you know, he's awful, he's this, he's that.
Right, but
it's not be right for it.
It takes, a parent's got to really grapple with that. A parent is, yeah. Again, I keep coming back to royalty because I kind of look at them thinking the way the royals do. Like you saw the King's Speech, the movie The King's Speech.
Yeah,
right, so there's the one son who's just not appropriate for this position, right? What was the brother's name? I forgot his name.
Charles Edward.
The one who marries the girl from Baltimore and the whole thing.
The divorcee. Edward.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. Right, so Edward is not appropriate for it, but he was dynamic, and he was, everyone loved him.
Anti-Semitic.
Very charismatic, and a good speaker, right? In certain extent, he would seem like the more natural fit, but he really wasn't appropriate. But it's a hard thing for the parents to say, you know what, we need somebody with a little higher character for this position. And the other brother, maybe was a higher character, but wasn't as charismatic, wasn't as obvious a fit for the job. And you could see how a parent would make that mistake. Yeah?
If you read the Quran, you have Ishmael, who has all the characteristics of Yitzhak to be the leader of the people. Yeah. So it's told from their point of view. This is told from our point of view, and that's why it's so distinctive. Not good and a little less good, but good and wicked.
Right. Yeah. But Yishmael doesn't become wicked, really. He's not viewed as wicked in
No, but
in
he
history.
Has the characteristics of Isaac for the
right,
Muslims.
Right. For sure. All right, we'll stop here. So next week, we